Hello, and welcome to the Tommyknocker Tapes. The Tommyknocker Tapes are podcast interviews of Creed Repertory Theater's resident and guest artists with a focus on practical advice for the actor from diverse points of view. In today's podcast, I sit down with Nagel Jackson. Nagel's artistic experience is all over the board, having begun his career as an actor, then becoming a director at world-renowned theaters such as the Oregon Shakespeare Festival and San Francisco's ACT. After that, he ran the Milwaukee Repertory Theater and the McCarter Theater in Princeton till 1990. His most recent endeavor is as an award-winning playwright, having won the $150,000 prize in the Onassis International Playwriting Competition, and also being the director of new play development at Colorado's Denver Center. He continues to direct as well, and has worked at most major repertory theaters throughout the U.S., from Hartford Stage to the Old Globe in San Diego. Nagel was a Fulbright Fellow, holds an honorary Doctor of Humane Letters degree from Whitman College, and he is also a member of the Dramatists Guild and the Society of Stage Directors and Choreographers. In this podcast, Nagel plays the theater heretic and tackles head-on the assumptions many of us have about directors, actors, and even theater itself. So I'm sitting at the top of Tommyknocker Tavern with Nagel Jackson. And Nagel, I'm going to start this off by asking the same question I ask everybody, because I like to hear their answers. And the question is theater actually vital? I know it had people say it had a heyday, there's a lot of death talk, that we have movies and television now that seem to have taken over as far as performing arts go, in a sense. Does theater still hold the same vitality that it always did?
Well, yeah, you know, the word vital can mean two things. It means, is it just alive, as in vital signs?
Yeah.
And it is very, very much so. And in fact, I'm delighted that film and television have taken over a lot of the stuff that we used to have to do. In other words, the theater used to be the only show in town. I'm talking now about the 19th century and so on, and into the 20th. So we had to do the big melodramas and the historical pageants and all that stuff. You know, along came the cinema, and they do it much better. Mm-hmm. And then television came along, and the sitcoms that you see on television now used to be the stuff of Broadway comedies, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's a great thing, actually. The so-called popular media has taken a huge burden off of our shoulders. We don't have to do all that junk. It's being done by other people. That's fine, and they do it much better and make it more exciting than we ever could anyway, so why not? So when I hear people say, oh, the theater's dying because of television movies, I say, no, it's just that we now can work on stuff we really want to do.
Uh-huh.
As far as the life of theater in this country, it's just extraordinary. I mean, when I was a young man starting out, you had to go to New York. That's all there was. I'm so lucky. I grew up with the Lort theater movement. Uh-huh. But when I was just getting out of college, I mean, there was the Guthrie in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. There were just a handful. The Alley in Houston and the Cleveland Playhouse, the Little Hedgerow in Philadelphia, and so on. But now, every major city has not only a big flagship theater, but at least five or six satellites, you know.
Right. Yeah.
It used to be, it was nothing but Broadway and then the traveling road shows. The first shows I ever saw were in Seattle. I grew up in that part of the world. And they were, you know, like Oklahoma and stuff, the national traveling company, playing at the old Moore Theater in Seattle. But now, you know, Seattle is just alive with theater.
Yeah.
With the Rep, the Interman, and the Contemporary Theater, and a bunch of others, too. So I always just chortle when people say, oh, the theater's on its way out. They don't know.
Uh-huh.
There's, in fact, it's a dangerous thing to say, there's probably too much.
Really?
Well, I'll tell you, once I was the chair of, when I was running the McCarter Theater, uh-huh. We were the biggest theater in the state of New Jersey.
Right.
So we were hosting a conference for TCG, Theater Communications Group.
Okay.
And, theaters from like Maryland, Delaware, that area, the Mid-Atlantic. I walked into that room, and I mean, there were like 70 or 80 theaters represented there, and I sat next to Peter Zeisler, a wonderful man who's not with us anymore, who was the chief founder of TCG, and I turned to him very quietly in his ear. I said, there are far too many people in this room, because there can't be that many good actors, designers, right. Directors, you know, obviously I mean, they're just, it can't.
Right.
Like, there can't be 300 baseball teams, you know. Uh-huh. There just aren't going to be enough players.
Right.
So a lot of the theaters are probably doing bad work. Huh. And they eventually atrophy and go away. Yeah, yeah. But still, if you look down in a telephone directory and see how many theaters are in a town, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's a lot of good theater.
Right, right. So as a director, put that hat on for a second, you've had the opportunity to work in amazing theaters, and I would hope these theaters were hiring amazing actors. Of the, all of those actors that you've had the opportunity to work with, what are some of the habits that they have that I can steal?
It isn't a habit, it's an instinct. And, I mean, that which raises a thorny issue, are actors born?
Uh-huh.
And to a certain extent, I think they are. The main ingredient to the really all the best, greatest actors I've worked with is that they all share one thing, and that is the obligation to communicate. Not the desire.
Uh-huh.
We can all have the desire, you know.
Right.
The obligation. It's like a muscle. They absolutely have to communicate whatever it is they're doing, feeling, etc., in the role,
mm-hmm.
to the last row, you know, of the house, whether it's a 50-seat house or a 3,000-seat outdoor arena.
Right.
They just have that obligation. And they don't need voice lessons. They don't
uh-huh.
need speech lessons, because they have perfect diction, because they have to get it across. They don't want anyone to miss the wonder of themselves. and that's great, and that's what makes, you know, some of the greatest actors I've worked with, and some are were had really, I mean, voice teachers would die, you know, these horrible raspy voices
uh-huh.
and so on.
Right.
None of them had sloppy diction, because you can't do that and communicate. But
right.
And some of them moved in very awkward, strange ways and so on. I mean,
uh-huh.
you think of people like Burt Lahr, for instance, the great American clown,
uh-huh.
the lion in Wizard of Oz and
yeah,
so on.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was a guy with an impossible voice and one of the ugliest faces and just a great, great comic actor who owned his skills because he had an obligation to communicate. I don't think that can be taught. I think it can, however, be absorbed by just being around theater a lot, you know. I grew up, my parents started the little theater in the town that I grew up in Walla Walla, Washington. And so I was always hanging around, you know, from the third grade on, I was always hanging around rehearsals. You know, I mean, the work was probably not very good, but that's not important.
Yeah.
I was constantly watching people get up on a stage and put on plays and so on. It was
right.
just, it became a thing that was just sort of instinctual with me, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I started not just as an actor, started as an actor professionally with the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, but I was also working nightclubs
mm-hmm.
and doing a lot of musical comedy.
Mm-hmm.
So working as a solo in clubs and doing cabaret reviews, and that's it. Everything was about. And boy, when you play nightclubs, you learn how to handle an audience.
Yeah, I bet.
You've got to keep them on your side,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you will do anything to do that.
Huh.
That's different than acting. Acting is a whole different thing, where you're playing, your receiver is the actor opposite you.
Right.
Whereas for a performer, your receiver is the audience.
The audience.
They're two
yeah.
different things.
Yeah.
I found out, I mean, I was fairly successful as an actor. I was a comic actor mainly, just a few straight roles. But I realized at one point that I really was more of a performer than an actor.
Huh.
You know, I knew if anybody moved in row Q,
uh-huh.
I was aware of it.
Uh-huh.
And then I would say, what am I going to do to get those people, you know, back?
Right.
That sort of, so I would do roles like some of the roles I did at Ashland, like Benedict in Much Ado,
yeah.
talks to the audience a lot,
yeah.
and Autolycus in The Winter's Tale,
mm-hmm.
ditto, that
yeah.
sort of thing. Yeah. Once I had to go on, once I was at ACT as in San Francisco as a assistant director to Bill Ball during the golden age of that company,
mm-hmm.
and they knew I could act, so I was always getting understudy jobs as well. And I had to suddenly go on in a rock musical,
mm-hmm.
One of the first rock musicals based on Twelfth Night, a musical called Your Own Thing. And I suddenly had to go on in the lead of that. Mm-hmm. And so I had to learn it fast. I was playing opposite Bonnie Franklin, I remember. And Don Johnson was in that show, too. When they were both very young. And I was very young, too. I had to leap into that thing. And so I just walked out on stage and just, you know, reacted to people. Uh-huh. I had a couple of songs, too. But mainly, I just reacted to people. And then, you know, uh-huh. My wife was in the house that night. And she came back afterwards. She said, "That's the best thing you have ever done." And I realized she was right. I was just acting. I uh-huh. wasn't performing. Huh. It was around that time I decided to quit.
No joke.
The acting profession.
Wow.
Because I thought, oh yeah, that's what it is. And it frankly doesn't interest me that much. I used to love rehearsals. But once the show was open, it was sort of like, did we have to do it again? You know, that was not a big deal for me.
Huh. Wow.
So fortunately for the American theater, I left the acting profession.
So, also then, as a director, basically, what do you spend most of your time doing in prep?
I read the play. I read the play a lot. I love to do research. I love to research the life of a playwright, particularly, and find out at what point they wrote this play and what mm-hmm. was going on in their life, stuff like that. A lot of that's just purely curiosity.
Really?
And I love to do historical research. And, mm-hmm. and some years ago, I directed a production of The Show Off at the Denver Center, written by George Kelly in the mm-hmm. 20s. Well, he grew up in a particular neighborhood of Philadelphia, mm-hmm. and this play is set there. Well, I live in, you know, New Jersey, just across the line. So I went there and spent a day in that neighborhood with my camera and just walking around and talking to people and getting the feel of that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Stuff like that is great. But that's all gravy. It's important mm-hmm. gravy. It's very important gravy. And it's great to be able to share that with actors. And stuff.
Right.
But then there comes a point when you really have to sit down and figure out the staging of this play, mm-hmm. by which I mean good old-fashioned blocking. You need to do that so the designer isn't tearing his hair, mm-hmm. you know, and you come in one day and say the kitchen's left and the next day the kitchen's on it right. Mm-hmm. This is very unfashionable nowadays. Mm-hmm. They're teaching directors now go in with a clean slate,
right?
You know, so that you can arrive at all this organically. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, great. That's fine if you have 3 months. And they're always using Site Europe as the model. You know, say, well, you know, right. that's the way it's done in Europe, and so on. Yes, and they also rehearse for 3 months in Europe.
Right.
But we never get that. So if you haven't done your homework. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that's the way the play's going to end up looking, but at least you're not going to waste the actor's time figuring stuff out that you should have figured out before.
Right.
And there is a lot of time wasted, and it's always the actor's time that is wasted. Huh. Because, you know, we're going to sit around and do table work for 2 weeks. Great,
right.
fine. And we do that, and that's fun. Everybody loves to sit around and do table work.
Sure.
Easy as pie. Great fun. And then suddenly the producer will say, you open in 10 days.
Right.
You know? And then it's scramble, scramble, scramble because mm-hmm. because the director hadn't done his or her homework.
Huh.
And so I know a lot of the argument is that, well, if you've done all that, then you've closed all the doors of possibilities. You know,
uh-huh.
that's absolutely untrue. I come in with the show pretty well blocked on paper,
right.
and then I change everything.
You know? Yeah.
But at least you can start somewhere, and the actors aren't bumping into each other,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so I just think all the arguments I hear about don't do blocking in advance, they all boil down to one thing, and it's laziness. So I do that. When I'm working with classics, I discovered this a few years ago. A lot of other directors have known that. I've since found out. I was doing a production of Antony and Cleopatra, and I was making some rather, it was my fourth Antony and Cleopatra, well, twice as an actor and once before as a director. And so I know the play very well. But I was making a major cut. I was removing the whole plot about Pompey. Shakespeare was very interested in that for the first two acts and then drops it like a hot potato. And about an hour later, someone says casually, oh yeah, Pompey was defeated. You know, and you say, well then why did we have to go through all of that?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So anyway. That could lead me into a discussion of the texts that we have of Shakespeare in the plays. I'm convinced that they're not the texts that were actually produced. Uh-huh. I think they were the starting text. Uh-huh. And then, they, you know, the famous thing about the 2 hours traffic of our stage, and you say, mm-hmm. how could any play be done in two hours?
This long,
they weren't.
Right.
The complete texts were never done, I'm sure. They were cut, and then what they put on probably ran about 2 hours. So, but fortunately, we have all the material, so we can make choices.
Right.
At any rate, long way around the barn to say, since I was making those revisions, I decided it would be easier than having the actors do all these red pencil cuts, to just retype, to type out the addition of Antony and Cleopatra that I wanted to do.
Wow.
Well, that's what I thought, oh, it's going to be a hard job. Mm-hmm. It was so much fun. It was just great fun. And the result of it is that I had dealt with every single line and every single word of that play, you know, instead of skipping over a little passage here and, or having a vague sense of what this is about. I had to deal with each one. And being a writer myself, though not exactly in Mr. Shakespeare's class, it was fun, however, to share the experience of writing that play. Mm-hmm. And so I do that now whenever I'm doing a classic or a very highly verbal play. And I've since met many directors who say, oh yeah, I always do that.
Okay.
I've also known actors who will write out their roles in either longhand or type them out all their line just so that they've dealt with every word.
Right.
I mean, it'd be hard to do if you're doing a mammoth play or something like that, you know, because you have a lot of half lines. And but anything that has a certain literary quality, and I don't mean to diss Mr. Mammon at all, I love his work, but you know what I mean.
Yes.
Doing a Shaw or something like that. To write out the role is a great way to really be sure you've dealt with everything.
So you've already touched on, in rehearsal, coming in with blocking and some and the ideas of the new style of getting things organically and whatnot. So aside from that, or in addition to that, how would you prefer, after you come in, you have your blocking, how would you prefer your rehearsal process to run? What is your ideal process in which you in your interaction with the actors?
The ideal process, it all depends on how much time you have, but ideally you spend 2-3 days of table work, just reading. But then I get it up on its feet, always with the advisement to the actors that they're not to be terrified that this is frozen in stone, that, you know, this blocking is what they're going to open with three weeks later. Just purely as a starting point so that, as I always say, so that we're not bumping into each other. And it also, it shows the actors sort of my idea about the flow of scenes, about the action within the scene. You know, I mean, if you're playing a part and you're constantly with your back to the audience, obviously the director has some different feeling about this role than you do.
Exactly, yeah.
And so that could lead to a question, well, why am I standing with my back to the audience all the time? You know, and then the director would probably say, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean for that, whatever, and you change it, and so on. But it's a starting point. It's just an efficient use of time, rather than wasting everybody's time hemming and hawing over, should we put the sofa here, or should we put the sofa there?
Right.
You know, put it somewhere, for God's sake, and then you'll find out.
Right.
So that's my idea. And then, getting into the second week, we start to really explore and probably change a lot of the initial decisions and so on. But then there comes a certain point where I just sit back and let them just do it and do it and do it. You know, as I've said many times, the French word for rehearsal is répétition.
Right.
And repetition is a great thing. And that's also when you find out if what you're doing is dead wrong. You know, but you have to, Bill Ball was a great mentor to me. Bill would never, or rarely, would never interrupt a scene the actors were doing. He would wait till it was completed, and then he would say, now, this is wrong, and that's, you know, and, you know, look at the mess you got yourself into by doing this, that, and the other. But he would never stop them in the middle and say, no, don't do that. And you can always spot a really young, inexperienced director because they're constantly stopping the actors. Right. They want it all right now. They want the results right now. They want to see the performance right now. And the greatest thing one has to learn, I think, directing, is patience. You have to sit there, and sometimes it's really agonizing. Sit there seeing something that's just going to hell in a handbasket, and you just sit there and let it crash, you know, and then you can say, see,
right,
this
right.
probably was not a good way to do that scene. But they have to find out. You have to do it. And you have to find out, too. You know, you have this brilliant directorial idea, and then you look at it, and it's bullshit.
Right,
and,
right.
But you can't tell that until it happens.
Yeah. So you started out as an actor and then came into directing. And I found, with a lot of people especially that I've interviewed for this podcast, a lot of the directors started out as actors. Do you think it is, and these are good directors that I've worked with, do you think it's a requisite that directors should start out as actors?
Well, it's probably not a requisite because one can name some great directors who were not actors, although usually you find that they did have some practical experience that was pretty closely related to that.
Do you feel that they were just exceptions to the rule?
Perhaps it also depends on the, well, I was going to say on the kind of director. I mean, the highly, like a Robert Wilson or someone, the highly visual and stylistic directors, probably, you know, it's because what they're doing is something that's a little different to begin with, right? Okay. Very presentational.
Uh-huh.
I frankly don't trust a director who has not been on stage, because I don't see how you can tell an actor what to do unless you know what it's like to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose some would dismiss that as being simplistic, but mm-hmm. But on the other hand, use sports analogies a lot, I guess, but I mean, I wouldn't trust a baseball manager who hadn't, you know, played shortstop or something,
yeah,
who had some knowledge of what it feels like to be out there.
Right.
And I think you don't have to have been a good actor, you know, but just have been on a stage, have the responsibility of creating a role and performing it for an audience and so on. I think you have to have done that, and not just once, but, you know, a certain number of times. To fully understand, so that you can speak the language of the actor. I mean, I don't see how you can speak the language of the actor if you've never been up there.
Right.
Because the terms that we have that have come down from so many, you know, different drama schools, they're all so confusing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the beat and the motivation and the this, that, and the
other
thing. I try to avoid using any of them if I can.
Really?
When I'm working. But you just have to... sort of. I think you have to have been there. I really do.
Uh-huh.
I don't think you have to have been brilliant.
Right.
But you have to have been there.
I wanted to connect to something you said before, talking about, you spoke about wanting to find out the history of the writer.
Yeah.
And this is something that fascinates me as well. I do, when I try and do plays, I do try and figure out where the writer is and what the writer's doing, because just how they would have colored this line from where they were coming from, I find very important. So as a writer, so switch hats for a second, as a writer, how would you, or what would you tell actors if they were doing your work, for example, what they should know about you, or how they should, how should they look into writers to glean information from them to inform their choices to make better choices on the text?
Well, my life is extraordinarily dull. So, unfortunately, there's no biography. I don't know that they would find anything particular about me in the plays I write, except to see the kind of plays that I've directed. You know, I mean, I was for a while sort of known for French theater, for very good reason that much of my background and training was in France.
Oh.
But so I did a lot of Molière and a lot of Fado and a lot of stuff like that, and that's. That's you can see that in my writing as well, I suppose. But in general, what I would like when actors look at my plays, first thing I say is look at the punctuation. You know, because that's really indicative. Since I was an actor and a director before I began writing,
right?
When I write, I really hear the play,
and
I really see the play. It's happening right in front of my eyes as I write it. And I give as many indications as I can. Doesn't mean that that's the only way to do the play, but it tells you what my vision of the play was.
Certainly.
So that if there's an ellipsis there, and I use them a lot, and there's a lot of dot, dot, dot in my plays, it means this is a quiet moment. This is someone to hold here. There's a reason for those. Just as if it's a dash, it means that you're cut off, you know,
right.
Those distinctions. But a lot of other things, too. I mean, I will write sentences that are not really, and so do a lot of playwrights now. that are not grammatically correct. Uh-huh. You know, the verb will be missing or whatever, but the period there means that's the end of that sentence, right, even if it's not complete. And the stage directions that I give, and I don't give them frivolously. Mm-hmm. If I have a stage direction, I'm not talking about a physical direction, like, you know, left or right or something like that. Those creep into printed texts as a result of the stage manager's copy, which is usually what goes to the publisher. But if I, well, a great writer's stage directions, as we both know, having just worked on an mm-hmm. Albee play, is Edward Albee. His stage directions are just wonderful.
Yeah.
And there's that whole school of acting, which actors have been told to ignore all stage directions.
Uh-huh.
Just go for the text. Just go for the text. Well, that is such nonsense. Because,
really?
I mean, with the classics, we don't have stage directions, so that's fine.
Right.
But nowadays, why not pay attention to what the playwright had in mind? You may not agree with it, but why not at least pay attention to it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Albee is so wonderfully precise and gives such marvelous analogies. Mm-hmm. You know, that it's nothing but helpful to an actor. To ignore them, I think, would be really just, you know, it's just cutting yourself off from a good conversation with the playwright.
Uh-huh.
That you would probably like to have had, but he's not around. So at least read what he thinks about it.
Now, in the same sense of the stage manager's copy, putting in things like moves left, moves right.
Okay.
Do you believe that is there still the fear of the stage manager's copy affecting like cries or writing in those as well?
No, I don't think that happens. The silly stage directions that you don't, well, obviously left and right, and you know, extra
sure.
kitchen stuff like that.
Yeah.
Depends on the set and the production, and you don't worry about that at all. But mm-hmm. but things like, I mean, some writers do write, put in sappy, direct, you know, like with emotion. I mean, you know, what the hell, what emotion?
Right,
you
right.
know, what does that mean?
Uh-huh.
But you can spot pretty quickly whether you're dealing with a playwright who really understands an actor,
uh-huh.
or whether you're just dealing with someone who has a vague sense of theater.
Right.
If you can see that the directions are quite specific and so on, then I think you have to pay attention to them. Do you have to do them? No, but
mm-hmm.
you'd be a fool not to try.
Uh-huh.
You know, at least give it a try, because why did he write that?
Okay. Right. Well, I know I have to admit that from the school of acting that I've come from, that was a huge thing. And I remember on the first read-through, I just, out of complete and utter habit, just blacked those out. I mean, I read them the first thing, and I was like, yeah, no, I get all that, but I just blacked because that's just what I was taught to do.
Absolutely.
And then I'm in the first talk, you're like, pay attention to these, and I'm just kind of sitting there, and I'm sitting right next to you thinking, oh, shit, I hope he doesn't look at my script. So that was a nervous moment for me.
Well, you know, there's been a whole school of, it's unfortunate, it comes from academia, from a lot of frustrated theater artists who are not in the profession and would like to be, and they've developed a certain sort of disdain for the writer and a disdain for a lot of, I guess, what, the tools of the trade. They look down upon it as being anti-artistic or something like that.
Right, I mean, the argument to us was given that this is going to, it's going to hem in your choices of what you're able to do now.
Well, if you're playing Hamlet, a lot of your choices have already been hemmed in, because you're playing the Prince of Denmark,
right,
and you're going to do these things that a prince would do and that somebody else isn't going to do. And it doesn't hem in your choices, it just gives you one more.
Uh-huh.
You know, how about the playwright's choice?
Right.
You know, I mean, give it a whirl.
Uh-huh.
It's one more choice.
So on a completely different note, in a more in a really practical sense, and I guess this is a totally selfish question, if, say, an actor wants to try and get himself or audition for the larger companies, what is it about those companies that I should know, or that any actor in my position should know about trying to audition? Is there a difference?
When you say those companies, I take it you're talking about the big
I'm talking about big Lord theaters.
The big houses,
yes.
The major houses, yeah. Which used to be the only houses in
right.
most cities, but, yeah. That is a very hard question. I don't think there's nothing in terms of how you audition that's going to be any different
okay.
for a Lord A or B mm-hmm. as opposed to a Lord D.
Right.
an actor is an actor or he's not. Uh-huh. And they'll see that in the audition, so, you know, and, I mean, you don't audition bigger for a bigger theater.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Frankly, I mean, it scares me to death to think what I would do if I were coming up in theater now. I just was so lucky. I was going into the theater at the same time that the theater was expanding.
Right.
At the same time that these companies like ACT and so on were just beginning. And so when I started, for instance, at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, it was still a non-equity company, a very small company, and just worked. We just performed in the month of August.
Nice.
And then, you know, now it's the biggest professional theater in North America.
It's huge.
It's huge. So huge. I walked in there, I can't even find my way around anymore. But it's all, I hate to say this, it's so cynical, but I know it to be true now, that since the theater is so vital, as to go back to the beginning of this conversation,
sure.
Since there are so many of them now, networking is the most important thing.
Okay.
You just have to meet people. Mm-hmm. You just have to get to them. You have to... My motto has always been, with talking with students and actors, is take the job. You know, people come up to me and say, you know, I've had an offer from this funny little company, I don't really think it's what I want to do. And I cut them off halfway and say, take the job. Because you never know who you will meet.
Uh-huh.
You know, some of the most important people that I've worked with, I met in wild little production in odd little places. And then, you know, but then suddenly they advance or I advanced or whatever. You
right.
just never know.
Uh-huh.
So it's so important just to find yourself working in any capacity in a theater.
Right.
Because that's where you're going to meet the people who will affect your career. And you will affect other people's careers as well.
Sorry.
But it's in the networking. And it's really hard to break into these big companies now. They have got, you know, now they all have casting directors and such, which we never used to have. And I have strong feelings about that, too. We won't get into that. But, and to get on their radar and so on, you know, the hard thing is not what you do in the audition room.
Mm-hmm.
The hard thing is getting the audition and being taken seriously.
Right.
You know.
Definitely.
But as far as the audition, there's nothing, there are no tricks, there's nothing you can do except what you are,
right.
That's all. And they'll see that, and there's no way you can fake it, there's no way, you know. And if it's not what they're looking for, there's not a damn thing you can do about it.
Absolutely not.
A dear friend of mine has just auditioned for this upcoming production of Cyrano de Bergerac that Kevin Kline is doing, and he emailed me the day before and said, can you give me some advice? I'm auditioning for the role of Homo Fleury, the actor that they make fun of and kick out in the first act.
Yeah.
Well, I've done Cyrano, so, you know, I told him, because he had played some roles for me that were rather like that, and I said, just remember how you did Orant in The Misanthrope, you know.
Uh-huh.
At any rate, so he went in, he did a very good audition, so he didn't get the role, but he'd be perfect in the role. He'd be absolutely perfect in the role. And so would 12 other people.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's the unfortunate truth.
Right.
And so the casting agent, or I hope in this case the director, you know, probably had in mind someone with red hair. Who knows what they had
sure.
in mind, you know?
Yeah.
You can't, there's nothing you can do about that. All you can do is just be yourself and do the role the best, you know, not try to amaze anybody. With some incredible new interpretation, you know, like
okay.
coming in doing Hamlet falsetto or something.
You know, yeah,
this
yeah.
is not going to interest anybody. but it's getting the audition that is the trick.
Mm-hmm.
And there again, networking. You know, if you know someone in the company and someone in the company knows you, it just makes it so much easier.
Right.
And the only way you're going to meet people in these companies, right? Is to work with them when they're on the way up as well.
Right, right. Another question that I like to ask a lot of the people that I interview is, outside of theater, and as an artist in general, we do these things on stage and in the theater. What do you do in particular outside of theater that you feel fuels you as an artist that isn't necessarily theater? Because hopefully we don't sleep in the theater house. So what is it that you do that
right.
supports you and bolsters you?
I love painting. And I go to museums all the time. I just love it. I travel. I love to travel. I spend a month every year in Paris. Okay. Just going to theater, but also going to opera. I'm a huge opera fan.
Uh-huh.
And classical music in general. Lots of music. I like country western. I like all kinds of music. I don't go to the theater that often. I used to. I don't now. It's not nothing about that it's bad or anything like that. It's just that I've seen so much that it really, you know, it has to be something pretty special. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it is like a busman's holiday. You think, oh, I'm just going to sit and relax, and then you don't.
Right.
you don't. You get, you know, interested in, oh, why are they doing that, or what they're doing this, and isn't that wonderful, and that wild, and so on. But, or isn't that dreadful?
Right.
You know,
yeah.
That too, which is so discouraging. Some people love to go to plays just to see how bad they are.
It, yeah.
You know, and that's ridiculous. That's suicidal. That will shorten your life in a hurry. I love the. I love all the arts. I'm very into all the arts. I'm also a big baseball fan. And,
uh-huh.
You know, other things like that. Mm-hmm. Love to go to the track. my wife is a horsewoman, so she taught me all about horses.
Yes.
And I read avidly. Uh-huh. For a while, wonderful. For about 5 or 6 years, maybe more, I was one of the book critics for the newspaper in Trenton, which is nearby, the state capital of New Jersey, the Trenton Times. And I was the one of the book critics for that, which was great. Every other month, a pile of books would arrive on my front porch,
awesome.
You know, and I just picked the ones I wanted to read and then write reviews of them and get paid to do it.
Huh.
And as a result of that, I read all kinds of stuff I would not have read otherwise because I wouldn't have known about these wonderful
right,
books.
Right.
So I have, right now I'm reading all 20 of Zola's. Emile Zola wrote a series of novels called the Rougon-Macquart novels. At any rate, tracking a particular family, all their relations and so on for about over a 30-year period during what's called the Second Empire in France. And I'm reading all of them. I'm up to number 18 now and
wow.
Just loving those. Just great. And unfortunately, very few of them are translated into English, so they're not well known.
Oh, okay.
I can read them in French, thank God.
Oh, I bet, yeah.
But, yeah, I'm an avid reader.
So, it's a... For me, I guess the question has come up so often. I've asked it to as many people as I possibly can, and I've reading has come up a lot.
Yeah.
I'm thrilled, because I love to read as well, so I'm sort of, oh, good, great, all these actors that I respect, artists that I respect, love to do the same thing I do. I happen to be a huge nonfiction reader.
Yeah.
And I find a lot of people, a lot of newspaper readers, staying up with the world, keeping up with the world, this idea of being a professional human being. What is it that you read in particular? Do you have something that you, is there just a general, or is it sort of like your musical taste, it's all over the board?
It is kind of all over the board, but it's probably easier to say what I don't read. I've never gotten interested in science fiction.
Uh-huh.
I sort of admire it, the skill involved, but I just... Uh-huh. I always find, I can't suspend my disbelief, you know. I'm always reading and say, yeah, fine, but. I love to read biography. And not just of artists, of all sorts of people. Political biographies, all kinds of biographies. And I do love a good novel, no question about it. I mean, one that really takes time. There's a Portuguese writer named Saramago, won the Nobel Prize about 4 years ago. I just love his work, and it's all being translated. So that's great.
Yeah.
But, my tastes are pretty Catholic with a small C. it just whatever looks like it's going to be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, unfortunately, I suppose, I'm pretty bad about reading the latest contemporary fiction. Uh-huh. A lot of people say, well, you know, certainly you've read such and such and such,
right.
And I just haven't.
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
You mentioned before your idea of acting schools, these ideas of the drama theory and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Is this sort of just a wide ranging? Because having had done most of your studying in France, I'm assuming that there must have been some sort of general philosophy or idea that was given to you there. No. Oh, wow.
Let me tell you, first of all, I didn't major in theater. I was a French and English major. I had a liberal arts college,
uh-huh.
One of those good colleges where you could still be in the, I was on stage all the time. I was always involved in the shows, but I didn't have to be a drama major. In fact, when I started out this college, they didn't have a drama major. And I don't, it's not that I don't approve, I don't recommend theater as a major as an undergraduate.
No kidding.
I think you have, the stuff you're really going to use is history and art and literature and all that. That's mm-hmm. what you're really going to use in your career. The other stuff you can get in graduate school, you know, in a, getting a master's or whatever. Or, and I think it's a waste of 4 years of college to major in theater. Unfortunately, theater departments in colleges now mm-hmm. have got a stranglehold, and they don't let anybody, you know, work in the theater mm-hmm. in the, unless they're drama majors. Didn't used to be that way, but it is now, so that you kind of have to be, which is a shame. And also, I used to go around for the National Endowment and sort of do, what do I say, not adjudicating, but sort of evaluating mm-hmm. drama programs, you know, theater. And when I would talk with the people, I'd say, oh, it's great, you know, our students, they don't have to take any other courses at all, you know. They'd say they only have to take like two electives, and I'd say that is awful. Uh-huh. You should be ashamed of yourself. Said they should all have to take at least 2 years of a foreign language. Mm-hmm. They should all have to take history courses. They should all have to, ideally, art mm-hmm. history as well. All those things. Well, they just thought I was from another century, you know, because they want to turn out little theater machines. And that's exactly what they turn out. Uh-huh. And I got so tired of, you know, I'd be working with an actor and mention, you know, like the Russian Revolution, and they'll say, what's that?
Right.
You know?
Right.
So it's just maddening. And the good ones have figured that out. And they educate themselves.
Right.
And I'm afraid that the academics they've been working with don't help them. Uh-huh. So they know everything about theater except why.
So is there just a large dismissal of acting schools and styles in general?
No. There have been some wonderful, and I teach sometimes. I do master classes from time to time. Mm-hmm. But I think it should come later. I just don't think it should be at 18, 19, starting out in college. And there's a lot of other stuff. Or even if one were doing a drama major, which, as I say, now you almost have to in order
right.
to be able to do any theater work, they should insist. And the students themselves should insist that they take a lot of other stuff, that mm-hmm. they take a lot of literature and history and stuff,
right.
because that's what they're going to end up using. Mm-hmm. They're not going to end up using Voice 101, I'm sorry. But, uh-huh. You know, I mean, as I said earlier, an actor
right.
has that.
Right.
he or she insists on his body doing that.
Uh-huh.
And, if any voice teachers hear this, they've already thrown their machine
course,
across the
yeah.
wall. So,
is there a particular school then of thought on theater that you would recommend when they get to that place?
No, I mean, I don't know exactly what you mean by that. I mean, for instance,
there's Meisner and there's.
Oh right.
I
think those are all good. I mean, but I think to be tied to any system
mm-hmm.
is very limiting and also may not work for you. You know. I certainly never had any kind of system. I mean, I knew, for instance, what Stanislavski was, and I found out later about the Meisner, and you know, now this whole thing about viewpoints and so on and all of that. But a lot of that is a way for people to categorize something which should be happening instinctually.
Uh-huh.
And the reason they want to categorize it is because they think it makes it more important. I mean, we all in the theater have an inferiority complex because musicians have to play an instrument and they work many years and they practice every day and they do all that.
Right.
Dancers have a craft uh-huh. and a body that has to be developed and they have to work out every day.
Uh-huh.
Singers ditto.
Right.
Actors, we could wander into the theater after a good dinner and do the show,
uh-huh.
You know, and so we feel an inferiority. We feel like, you know, well, we're not really artists like ballet dancers or the guy who plays first oboe for the New York Philharmonic
sure.
or a great tenor or something.
Uh-huh.
You know, those are the real, we're cheating because we just kind of do it.
Do it, yeah.
You know, so people have been have evolved all these systems to give acting a kind of dignity that makes it seem like it's dancing or playing a musical instrument or something. You know, if you have a lot of terminology, and if people have to work, you know, in a lab for two or three hours, then it makes you feel like, you know, you're really doing something. On the other hand, in reality, an instinctual actor could walk in off the street and just knock your socks off without doing any of that work at all. So everything I'm saying here is such heresy.
Oh, I know.
But, you know, I think heretical views have to be aired as well. You know, then people can say, well, he's an idiot, but that's fine. But at least they should be out there.
So what do you teach in your acting master classes?
I have, this will amuse you after what I've just said.
Uh-huh.
I have a system called called a system of five. But it is purely, I always tell them, this is a tool. I said, if everything's going well, you don't even have to think about this. Uh-huh. I don't want you to think about this. This is to use when you get in trouble. When you're trying to analyze an action, it's just breaking down each action into five elements. I'm not going to go into it because it takes, you know, an hour or so. But I always tell actors, a lot of actors enjoy it and they use it. It's particularly good for comedy, working out comic business. And all. But I always say, this is just a tool. It's just something that I figured out one day when I was trying to analyze something. And I said, but it, don't ever use it as a starting point. Should it? Everything should happen just naturally.
People's computers are burning up right
That's
now.
That's right. Yale School of Drama just put my name up on a funeral pyre.
A blackball list. my final question. And for you seeing, having had been a part of the Lort sort of expansion, explosion, what have you. My main question is, having had seen all that and had been a major part of it, where do you now see this all going? Where do you see theater going? And especially the regional side of it. I mean, where do you see this going? Where would you want it to go?
I see it going up at 8 o'clock in the evening. I think theater, I don't know necessarily that it goes. And you know what I mean? It changes, and we have slumps, and we have brilliant periods, you know.
Right.
Wonderful period when Off-Broadway first started, when we had discovered the theater of the absurd from Europe, and everything changed, and that was a great time. Then there was the birth of the Lort theaters. That's a great time. And then the most recent thing has been the birth of all the other theaters, the so-called satellite theaters, and all that stuff that's going on. But it's just, it's a continually evolving thing, and it's, you know, right now I don't see anything terribly exciting going on, but that's perfectly normal. We're just waiting for the next big deal.
Sure.
And it'll happen, but there's no way to tell exactly where it's going to happen or what, and there's nothing we can do to push it and make it happen. But the point is, theaters all around this country are filled every night, and that just wasn't the case 40, 50 years ago. So I think the theater's extremely healthy now. But where it's going, I have no more idea. And I don't know where the opera world is going to either, which is an art form that I follow very closely. And lots of fascinating things are going on there. Well, one wonderful thing is that singers are now actors. You know, the old days of the fat lady are gone. Tries not to dismiss some wonderful fat sopranos whom I love dearly. But those ladies are having a harder time getting jobs these days because it's become real theater now, and that's wonderful. And, you know, and then there was for a time during the 70s, everything was, or 80s, 70s and 80s, everything was dance. Dance was the predominant. You know, all these wonderful dance companies, like Joffrey and L.A. Feld and all that happened. That was great. Now that seems to be fading, you know, but it'll come up again. I mean, we just, you know, we just go on. But we're not necessarily going on an upward path or a downward path. We just kind of go on.
Well, Nagel, thank you for a noisy but enlightening conversation.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
And I'd like to thank you for listening. If you'd like to find out more about Creed Repertory Theater, you can visit us on the web at www.creedrep.org.